Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Corey Zerlaw. I'm here on behalf of the appellants. My attorney registration number is 38750. I would like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal. The plaintiffs, the appellants, seek to reverse the trial court's pre-discovery dismissal with prejudice of their claims. Simply stated, the trial court abused its discretion in requiring the plaintiffs to make a prima facie showing of the merits of their claims prior to allowing any discovery and then dismissing those claims. The requirement of a prima facie showing prior to discovery not only goes against more than half a century of Colorado jurisprudence favoring full and complete discovery, but it goes against two Colorado Supreme Court decisions which looked at the issue of a prima facie requirement prior to discovery and struck it down both times. The court did this in the Curtis case, and in analyzing the situation, the court held that implementing a prima facie requirement contradicts the broader policy of the rules that all conflicts should be resolved in favor of discovery, and held that it was an abuse of discretion for the trial court to implement such a procedure in the case. After that case, there was another case, the direct sales tire case, where again the court looked at the idea of a prima facie showing requirement prior to discovery, and again struck it down, saying it's not proper.
Counsel, do you think that the Lone Pine analysis should never be applied in Colorado based on those two Colorado Supreme Court cases?
I believe the Lone Pine analysis is in direct conflict with the law of Colorado. We have two Supreme Court cases saying we don't require prima facie evidence or showings pre-discovery.
So is that a yes to my question then?
It is.
Mr. Zerba, what about the fact that when those cases were decided, Rule 16 was a little bit different from the way it is today? Would that make any difference?
I don't believe so. I believe that even if you look at Rule 16 today, while it does allow a trial judge to control its docket and implement some discovery controls, in this case, we weren't given any discovery. What the court did was not a discovery control. This wasn't limiting depositions or limiting requests for productions. This went beyond that. This required, the court asked for a prima facie showing on the merits before any discovery had been done, and that's not the law of Colorado. The law of Colorado is, if you set forth a prima facie claim in your complaint, which we clearly did, there's no dispute about that, then you're entitled to discovery under the current rules, Rule 16 and 26. That's the law of Colorado. That's the law we brought the case under and the law that applies today.
Well, Mr. Zerba, let me ask you this. A part of the defendant's contention is that some of the information that you were requested to or directed to provide in the Lone Pine order related to information that was within the control of the plaintiffs, specifically concerning their medical conditions. So why would that be objectionable under the court's Lone Pine order?
We did produce information about our clients' medical conditions, including records from their treating physicians that associated the clients or the plaintiffs' medical conditions with the defendant's oil and gas well activities. That's in the record at CD 687, that particular medical record. What we needed and what the court didn't give us is the information that was solely in the purview of the defendants. The chemicals that they were using on site, were there any spills? Was the well, the cement used to in the bore of the well, were there problems with that? That's the kind of information we need. We produced evidence of contamination in our water and in our client's air. What we needed to do is link it to what was used on site with the defendants, and we weren't given that information.
Now, counsel, hadn't you had an opportunity to go to the Colorado Oil and Gas Commission, and didn't they investigate the same case essentially that's before us now and conclude that there wasn't contamination on the property?
Well, the Colorado Oil and Gas Commission did produce a report, but what the Colorado Oil and Gas Commission's role is not to investigate claims on behalf of plaintiffs. They did some testing, but their test results did show some contamination, and if you look at the final concluding paragraph in the Colorado Oil and Gas report, they recommend that the plaintiffs go see a physician and ask the physician about the safety of drinking their water. But the point is, we should be entitled to investigate the Colorado Oil and Gas Commission's testing. Also, if you look at the report, they didn't get their samples sent to the lab the same day because they missed the FedEx delivery date. How does that affect the quality of their samples? Were their instruments calibrated that day? What else was going on? We're entitled to that kind of discovery, even if it is the Colorado Oil and Gas Commission. And we were denied that right. It's unreasonable and unfair to require us to meet a prima facie case on the merits without having any discovery whatsoever, especially when a large portion of the information we need is in the sole control of the defendants. It was an abuse of the discretion of the court to make such a requirement. It's really a straightforward issue of discovery in Colorado. In Colorado, we're entitled to discovery if you make a prima facie showing, a prima facie pleading in your complaint, which we did.
There was a motion for summary judgment filed as well, is that correct?
There was a motion to dismiss or in the alternative for summary judgment. And, okay. You know, if we were looking at a summary judgment standard, and at the beginning of discovery, when no discovery has taken place, and an affidavit is produced, like Dr. Kirk's affidavit, which says there's additional discovery that needs to be done, and this is what it is, under Colorado law, that would be enough to survive the motion for summary judgment. And it should have been enough to survive in this instance.
That motion was simply not addressed by the court?
It was. The court's order didn't address the motion for summary judgment. The court's ruling was couched in terms of Rule 37, Colorado's rule covering what happens when there are discovery problems, sanctions for not complying with discovery.
So it's your contention that's a sanction for a discovery violation? Is it your contention that the court's order was imposed as a sanction for a discovery violation, or simply a failure to meet the requirements?
It is our position that the court's order was a discovery sanction, which also goes against an entire body of law in Colorado that says for discovery, sanctions need to be commensurate with the conduct, and the least sanction possible to move discovery along should be implemented, and that the extreme sanction of dismissal with prejudice should only be used in extreme cases. And that's not the case here. There was no evidence before the court that we weren't cooperating in discovery. There was no evidence that we weren't answering discovery responses or that we were propounding abusive discovery on the defendants. We hadn't even gotten to that stage yet.
Mr. Zurich, in that regard, it appears that in responding to the motion to dismiss or in the alternative for summary judgment, you did not ask the court, pursuant to the summary judgment part of the motion under Rule 56F, for an opportunity to conduct further discovery. Is that correct?
I believe we did mention in our briefs that further discovery needed to be undergone. We didn't make a motion for further discovery, but it was addressed that we lacked the information needed. And that was true. We raised that in our opposition to the motion for a case management order, and we raised it again in the motions to dismiss. I don't think there was any question that there was a record of us continually saying throughout, we need this information to proceed, we need this information to proceed, and we were just denied an opportunity to get that information. For those reasons, we would request that the court's dismissal of our claims be reversed and that the matter be remanded for further proceedings. At this time, I would reserve my remaining time for rebuttal unless the court has other questions.
Very well, Mr. Zurich. You have almost 6 minutes left.
Thank you.
May it please the court. My name is Dan Dunn, and I represent the Antero defendants, appellees. I will be speaking today on behalf of all defendants, appellees. My attorney registration number is 10464. This case presents unique facts and circumstances that justified the trial court's discretionary use of a specially tailored case management order to reach a just and fair disposition of the case. This appeal does not require this court to blaze any new trail in Colorado law. It requires only that a straightforward application of basic case management principles and the rules of civil procedure.
Are there any precedents in Colorado that you rely on in contending that the court has the ability to require a prima facie showing by the plaintiffs before discovery?
There are none that we have found that specifically address that point, Judge Kopelke. However, there is a wealth of authority throughout the country that have endorsed this procedure. And
excuse me, Mr. Dunn, for interrupting, but before we get to authority from other jurisdictions, could you address the two cases that Mr. Zerbig mentioned that are from Colorado, that where the court held that a prima facie showing was not consistent with the discovery rules?
Yes, Your Honor. And you touched on one of the distinctions in your question of Mr. Zerbach. Those cases, the Curtis case and the direct sales case, were decided well before the 1995 amendments to Rules 16 and 26 of the Colorado Rules of Civil Procedure. Those rule changes in 1995 were a game changer in how discovery is viewed. The procedure for providing initial disclosures particularly was not in place then. And if you look at the rules, Rule 26A, and the detail with which initial disclosures must be made, it's clear in this case that all of the information that plaintiffs claim was in the exclusive possession of defendants and obtainable only by way of compulsory discovery outside of initial disclosures is simply not true. I'd be happy to go through in detail, in fact I will, exactly what information was made available to them in the initial disclosures. But I do want to point out one important thing. As I was getting ready for this oral argument, I took the time to go back and look at the committee comments to Rule 26. And this is not in the brief, so forgive us, but I did notice it, and it's very pertinent. Under the section that's called Colorado Changes under Rule 26, at the very end, there's two very important sentences. They basically state the following, that to the extent information is made available through disclosures, initial disclosures, additional discovery is not necessary. That's what it says. It goes on to conclude that discovery under this new system is extremely limited. Now, that is the answer, I think, to why Curtis and direct sales are distinguishable. In addition, direct sales is distinguishable because it was construing a statute, and the court found that there was no prima facie element in the statute that they were construing. I think the same is true for the Curtis case.
Mr. Dunn, based on your review of the committee comments, did you come across any discussion about the concept of prima facie orders?
No,
or orders requiring prima facie proof?
There's nothing that deals specifically with that topic. But I would mention that if we're looking for a textual basis, Colorado law that supports the issuance of a case management order of the type that was entered here, we don't need to look much farther than Rule 16C itself, which says for good cause shown, the court can alter the presumptive case management procedures and the discovery provisions that it contemplates. So what was good cause in this case? We don't think it's a serious question because the Colorado Oil and Gas Conservation Commission had found no contamination. We initial disclosures had been made. We provided the court with sworn affidavits calling into serious question the bona fides of the claim. There was no release. There was no incident involving release of chemicals to the environment. We were in compliance with all laws. The wind direction was in the wrong way, and no one other than the Struggleys had ever complained in the town of Silt about any contamination. So as to whether the court had the authority, the trial court, the authority to issue the case management order, we believe that three bases exist. One, the language of Rule 16C, the inherent authority of the court to control the disposition of cases, which is long recognized, and the town of Minturn is a case that we've cited. And two, the authority from all the other jurisdictions that have employed this procedure using comparable rules of civil procedure and comparable concepts. So that was, we really don't think that issue of, but let me turn to probably, as I reflect, I'm going to depart from my outline here, the most important issue before the court.
Well, before you do that, though, let me share with you my concern at this point. You started off saying that to your, that this would be easy for us because we weren't blazing a trail. But in order to get to where you want to go, we have to distinguish two Colorado Supreme Court cases along the way, because there is no other published decision out there that does what you want us to do today. Would you agree with that?
I would agree with you.
Okay.
I would agree with you. We have searched, and there is none that deals with this specific issue. Nonetheless, I think with the language of the rule and the other authorities we've cited, to an extent, Judge Roman, you are correct that there you need to be able to distinguish direct sales and Curtis, and we think we have, and we need to apply the rules of civil procedure in the way that we think was envisioned. You know, the 1995 amendments to the rules, you know, it was a significant change, and the concept of initial disclosures, if I could talk a little bit about that. Here is a type of information. First of all, let's step back one step. Dr. Kurt identified seven items that he thought merited further discovery. Let me dispel the myth that plaintiffs were not entitled or did not obtain discovery from defendants. They did. Initial disclosures, and I urge the court, if there's anything in the record to take a close look at, is those initial disclosures. You will find 36 separately identified discrete items of information that the documents covered, in addition to dozens of witnesses from the Colorado Oil and Gas Conservation Commission to other third parties that had information. So to suggest that they were not given discovery is not true. Disclosures are discovery. It's under Rule 26, and if you look at Rule 26b5, it says additional discovery, and it goes on to describe the other forms of discovery. So they got it, but here's what they got. They got all of the pertinent information regarding monitoring of the environment from Antero. That's in their disclosures. That was available to them. They got all of the information from CalFrac, Frontier, who stimulated the wells and drilled the wells regarding their well completion and hydraulic fracturing of the wells. All of the information regarding the chemicals that were used was made available to them.
How can they know that if they don't have the ability to have some follow-up discovery to determine if in fact they got everything or to get an explanation of some of the materials that were produced in the initial disclosure?
The information, Your Honor, fair question, was self-explanatory. It was information regarding the quality of water, the quality of the air emissions, and the materials used during the drilling and completion of the wells, all of the logs, all of the geological information, all of the information that an expert would need to characterize the source, quantify it, and the environmental media that lie between the source and the struggles. That information was available to them, or it was something that their own experts could find. If you look at Dr. Kurt's affidavit, suggesting that they need a dermatologist or a psychoneurologist to examine the plaintiffs is clearly something within the plaintiff's possession. But this is limited discovery. This is something, I think if we really take a step back, this information about whether plaintiffs were harmed because of defendants' activities is information we think should have been in the briefcase when they came to the courthouse to file their complaint. They should have had somebody, a medically qualified expert, who had told them these individuals are harmed from oil and gas-related chemicals. They may not have had all the details, but they didn't have that. And what they came forward with, after 105 days of opportunity, they did not ask for Rule 56F relief from the district court. They did not do that. They simply produced their expert reports as if that complied with the case management order without any explanation as to why it did not. There's no question it failed to do so.
Does the court have the ability in every case to initiate a procedure saying that after initial disclosures, we're going to require a prima facie showing for any further discovery?
I think that would be too broad of a statement, Your Honor.
And where would we find the abuse of discretion? What's different from this case? How does this case differ from other cases?
This case is different from other cases in the following respects. One, we had the COGCC report. Two, we had affidavits of the people that operated the wells that established that there was no release, nothing went wrong, there was no violation of any environmental law, that the wind blew in the wrong, in the opposite direction, and other information.
So, Mr. Dunn, if you had affidavits, I mean, you did have affidavits, and you had the COGCC report, why wasn't the mechanism of a motion for summary judgment sufficient in order to show that your case was meritorious?
We did move in the alternative for summary judgment. We thought it was sufficient.
Well, I understand that, but of course you also asked for the Lone Pine order, which the and the court granted your request in that regard.
Yes,
but,
we did.
But why don't, what I guess I'm trying to find out more specifically is, why did you think a Lone Pine order would be necessary as opposed to simply moving for summary judgment?
We thought at the beginning of the case that, is your question why we asked for the Lone Pine order in the first place and didn't immediately move for summary judgment?
No, why would you move, why did you move for a Lone Pine order at all when you could have used the mechanism of a motion for summary judgment?
Well, we moved for the Lone Pine order because we believe that Rule 16C provided us with that opportunity, and because of the other authorities that we had cited in our motion and subsequently when we moved to dismiss. We did not go for summary judgment. I frankly don't have an answer. I think at the beginning of the case, we presumed that, you know, this Lone Pine procedure would assist us in getting plaintiffs to produce what they should have had before they filed the case, and that looking back on it, we might very well have moved under Rule 56 for summary judgment as our initial move out of the box, but we didn't, and we certainly could have, because as you know, you can file Rule 56 motions at any time in a litigation. But I do think it's important that plaintiffs did not come forward. What we don't have here, and this is critically important, what we don't have is anybody from the plaintiffs or their experts saying specifically, we cannot reach opinions as to dose and causation without specifically identified information that is exclusively available to the defendants. That is nowhere in this record. They said it in their brief, but their experts simply say, I would like to have these seven categories of additional information. Nowhere does he say, I cannot reach a conclusion as to causation or exposure without this information. It's nowhere there. And if we do an analogy to Rule 56, under Rule 56F, they were required to come forward with specific affidavits that say exactly what it is they cannot adduce by way of affidavit within the time to respond to a motion for summary judgment.
But the ruling was not based on Rule 56. It wasn't a summary judgment order.
I understand. And it was only by way of analogy in response to Judge Taubman's question. Okay. That I mentioned that. I think let's talk about the district court's order. We believe that the authority to dismiss exists under three bases. One is the inherent authority of the court. Two is Rule 37 in two places, B2C and Rule 37B, C, which independently provides a basis for dismissal. Then there's Rule 41, B1. If we're looking for a textual basis for dismissal, those two rules, 37 and 41, provide it. In addition to, what was, I guess, inherent authority of the court is a sort of a vague concept. But if we recognize that the court had the authority under Rule 16C to issue the modified case management order, had good cause, which we believe is unquestionable here, then it necessarily carries with it the power to enforce that order. And what was the court to do when plaintiffs so clearly failed to comply with the order? They didn't even come close. what lesser sanction was available to the court? Well, we have a hard time thinking of one. Plaintiffs don't offer any lesser sanction to this court. And when your failure goes to the very core, the very heart of your case, which is dose, exposure, and causation are, when the heart of the case is removed from the body, or when the heart is removed from the body, the life terminates. And in this case, the court properly terminated the plaintiff's case.
Mr. Dunn, your time has expired.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Mr. Dunn. Mr. Zerbic, before you begin with your rebuttal, I wanted to ask you if you would like an opportunity to respond in writing to Mr. Dunn's comments regarding the committee comments to the amendments to Rules 16 and 26 from 1995.
We would.
Okay. I would like to ask you to provide a letter response of no more than 4 pages, double-spaced, to the court, to the judges on this panel, and to opposing counsel within, say, 10 days.
We can do that. Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
Your Honor, while the rules do allow a trial court discretion to create discovery controls and implement discovery plans, what the court did, what the trial court did in our case, was not implement a discovery plan. It was to implement in a proper new evidentiary hurdle. This was not a discovery date or deadline. It wasn't a limitation on discovery. This was an evidentiary hurdle that has never been implemented in Colorado before, and it's twice been rejected.
Mr. Zerbic, nevertheless, as Mr. Dunn alluded to, there have been decisions around the country where courts have issued lone pine orders and justified it based upon the either state or federal equivalent of Rule 16.
It's true, and a couple things. First, regarding Rule 16, the federal Rule 16 happens to have a sanction provision contained within its Rule 16. And it also, a lot of these cases in federal courts were done in the MDL, the multi-district litigation provisions of the federal court, which also give greater leeways for handling mass tort cases and multi-district cases. This was not a mass tort case. If you look at the cases cited in defendants' briefs, in the cases where lone pine orders have been applied around the country, it's almost uniformly been applied in mass tort situations. In the lone pine case itself, there are 462 defendants, 120 attorneys involved, and at least seven plaintiffs that were described as residences. That could be more. You can't tell from the unpublished trial court order. If you want to see a good history of the Lone Pine decision and an analysis applied in a case very similar to this, with a small number of plaintiffs against a small number of defendants claiming contamination from fracking, I would direct the court to look at the Roth decision cited in our reply brief. And in the Roth decision, it's a case out of Pennsylvania. The court went through the analysis and explains why a Lone Pine order is not appropriate in this type of case. And I would direct the court to review Roth for that information.
Counsel, can you address the effect of the revised CRCP 16 in 1995, not the comments? I know Judge Talbin has given you 10 days to respond to the comments, but in general, can you talk about the effect of the change that CRCP and the limited early discovery mechanism in that rule is?
My understanding of the changes were it was designed to encourage and foster greater production early in the case, not designed to limit discovery in any way, but to foster more discovery, to bring the discovery out early. And while, yeah, documents are produced in initial disclosures, there's no point in having a request for production for the same document. And so it's that kind of thing that it's going to. And, you know, in the, there's one thing I can note in the comments to Rule 16, it says, these rules have been drafted to emphasize and foster professionalism and to de-emphasize sanctions for noncompliance. That's in the comments section to Rule 16. So it did create some mechanisms for greater control over discovery, and it did put some emphasis on Rule 26 initial disclosures, but that's not, the Rule 26 initial disclosures were not meant to be the be-all and end-all of the case. You still get to follow up on those. You still get to cross-examine witnesses in relation to the documents produced. You still get to have time to give those documents to your experts and cross-examine the opposing party's experts on those documents. That wasn't allowed in our case. We were cut off from doing that. Defense counsel mentioned that Rule 16 disclosures were made in this case, and yeah, there were descriptions of documents produced, but those documents weren't produced to us until after the briefing had been closed on the motion to dismiss, well after the MCMO deadline for production took place. And you can see that in the attachment to defendant's reply brief, because it's the cover letter with which they provided those documents. The record shows that in the fall before that, we had requested the documents because there's a protective order in place. The reason the protective order is in place is because we had requested the documents from the defendants. They agreed not to produce them until we entered into a protective order. We entered into that protective order. It was signed by all the defendants, and those documents were not forthcoming after entry of that protective order. In response to their motion for the modified case management order, we say we need all this information, and we put out a laundry list of things we need. They still didn't respond with, well, here it is. We didn't get that information. We didn't get it until after the briefing was closed. And if you look at the exhibit, the second exhibit to their reply brief, there's a letter from my co-counsel, Tate Kunkel, in there. And in his opening statement, he says in that letter, this is the first time that you have offered to make these available to you. That's what's in the record on when we received those documents. And again, for these reasons, we believe the court exceeded its authority and abused its discretion in entering the loan fine modified case management order, that it runs directly against the law of Colorado, and that it was unreasonable and unfair to deny my clients the discovery that you would normally have in any personal injury tort action in Colorado. And with that, again, we respectfully would request that the court's order be reversed and the matter be remanded.
Thank you very much, Mr. Zerbic. Thank you, Mr. Dunn. Again, we appreciate your both of your excellent arguments this morning. I want to thank any counsel who are here who are from out of state or out of Denver for coming and participating and being present for the oral argument this morning. The case will stand submitted, and a written opinion will issue in due course.